time and defending the WBO lightweight title. I think she's one of the rising stars of women's boxing. I think she'll win on Saturday.
Yeah, go on, quick.
And Terry Harper's been a world champion already, but 4 years ago she was peeling spuds for 3 hours every morning in the local chippy. Get that, Jappers. That's what I like.
Nice to have the band back together.
Isn't it, Costello
and Bonds here. Is this going to be a podcast? Is that allowed?
I think so. If you don't mind being on a boxing podcast with us.
No, I'm honoured to be on a boxing podcast with you. Johnny Anson in for Gordon Smart after Jill McKenzie and the latest news. It's 10 o'clock.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Health officials in Lebanon say almost 500 people have been killed by Israeli airstrikes and more than 1,600 injured. Israel's defence minister said munitions belonging to Hezbollah had been destroyed in the strikes. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Daniel DeSimone, said the Israeli government was calling the operation a huge success.
They're saying they're going to keep going with this military campaign until they achieve their goal, which is to get 60,000 odd Israelis in northern Israel who've been displaced due to Hezbollah rocket fire. As we've seen, Hezbollah is still firing rockets, so that goal has not been achieved. That leaves a question about what next, what else is the Israeli military going to do?
The United States is sending a small number of additional troops to the Middle East because of heightened tension in the region. The Pentagon said it was taking the step out of an abundance of caution. Rachel Reeves has used her first Labour conference speech as Chancellor to rule out a return to austerity in next month's budget. She stood by the cut to winter fuel payments for pensioners, insisting that tough decisions were needed. But she promised that Britain's best days lie ahead. Nurses in England have rejected the government's award of a 5.5% pay rise for this financial year. The Royal College of Nursing said two-thirds of its members who voted turned down the deal. Harrods is starting an internal review looking at whether any current staff were involved in any of the allegations relating to Mohamed Al-Fayed. A former employee told BBC News that a manager who failed to investigate allegations of inappropriate behaviour still works for the company. And a Northern Ireland politician who uses a wheelchair says he felt angry and let down when his plane to Belfast took off from Birmingham Airport, leaving him on the ground. Andy Allen, an Ulster Unionist MLA, said he'd booked special assistance, but no lift was available to help him board.
I was frustrated, I was angry. I felt let down because I had done everything required of me when I booked the flights. I made Aer Lingus aware that I needed the assistance, that I couldn't walk up the aircraft steps at all. I couldn't obviously walk down the aisle. It was my expectation that that assistance would be in situ for me boarding the aircraft, and it wasn't.
Aer Lingus and Birmingham Airport have both apologised.
Matt Shawley,
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We are looking for a member of Matt's Parliament for New Forest East. Mick has got a claim. Hello, Mick.
In 1997, I proposed in a little hotel. I was actually in the bathroom.
What?
We were getting ready for dinner and I wanted it all to be sort of sorted before we went in and celebrated.
He's an addict, so just say the culture major's fault.
We're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are unfit owners can't become football club owners.
Matt Shawley, Monday to Friday from 2
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Well, hello, and welcome to the programme. Yes, it's Johnny in for Gordon Smart. How lovely to have Costello and Bunce back together as well. And thank you, chappers. Here we go, then. Loads to talk about on the programme between now and Dotton Adebayo at 1 a.m. How about this? Rachel Reeves delivered her maiden Chancellor's speech to the Labour conference this morning. The Royal College of Nursing in England rejected the government's pay offer, though. They released that statement around the same time, maybe stealing a little bit of thunder. We'll hear from the RCN. And just ask, look, was timing that deliberate or maybe just bad luck? We'll also be hearing about a campaign of anonymous poison pen letters, which residents of a village in Yorkshire have endured for 2 years. It sounds like a Netflix film, but actually, it's having an awful effect on the people that are living there. And also, really looking forward to this, Dr. Beat Joe Bennett will be with us for fascinating songs, loads of analysis of music. Dr. Joe coming up soon for a sneaky peek preview and talking about tonight's theme. And that's all between now and Dot and the Night Watchman, who opens up the nightclub from 1 a.m. So we begin in the Middle East, where Lebanon's health ministry has reported that at least 492 people are dead, including 35 children and 58 women, after heavy Israeli bombardment in the south of the country. 1,645 people have been injured, making it the deadliest day of the cross-border conflict since 2006. The Israeli military says it's targeted more than 1,000 Hezbollah positions across the region. The Iranian-backed group says it has fired dozens of rockets at Israeli military posts in northern Israel in retaliation. Let's get the latest on this from Olivia Podivan, journalist and news editor at L'Orient Today, and joins us from Beirut. Good evening to you, Olivia.
Good evening.
You are in the country at the moment. Can you just describe the situation there for us and what you've seen over the past couple of days, please?
Yeah, well, I think we've gone through all manner of emotions, from acute stress, panic, disbelief, and I think tonight, just an overwhelming sense of sadness at what we're seeing with, as you say there, those new casualty figures, making this today the deadliest day in Lebanon since the 2006 war between Hezbollah and Israel. But essentially what we've been seeing in the past 24 hours is a real kind of ladder of escalation. Obviously we had the night before these strikes from Hezbollah on Haifa in Israel, following a targeted assassination of a senior Hezbollah commander in the heart of Beirut suburbs, and various other attacks as well on military communication devices such as pagers. But then into this morning, we've seen a real shift with Israel announcing that it was broadening its campaign, which has involved hundreds of strikes across southern Lebanon, across villages all along the border, but far deeper as well than we've ever seen before. And that has resulted in tens of thousands of people having to up and leave within hours because the situation has become just so untenable and so dangerous. And what we've seen is, you know, bumper to bumper cars going all the way up the coastal road that links South Lebanon to Beirut, the capital, as well as people who are fleeing from the south coming to Beirut. We've also seen people from Beirut fleeing outside my office again, absolutely bumper to bumper traffic as people, desperate and scared, are trying to find new refuge for safety up in the mountains.
Olivia, there had been low-level conflict, I mean, for many years, but especially in the wake of the October attacks. This now has escalated dramatically over the past week, hasn't it, as you have said. What do you think is Israel's intentions with this? What is the end game? There's been obviously the talk about returning the Israelis to the northern border towns, but do you think that it is more than that?
Well, I think, you know, Israel's been pretty clear in terms of its military objective. For some months now, it's been very concerned about the 60,000 people who have been displaced since October 8th because of the incessant rocket fire coming over the border by Hezbollah, and that they feel that the only way to stop that is through military means. So, of course, it's important to note domestically there is a lot of debate about that. You know, with a lot of opposing groups in government there actually preferring diplomatic means. But essentially for Israel, they view Hezbollah as a real threat to their safety. Hezbollah is significantly better armed than Hamas. It has long-range precision missiles that can cause a lot of damage, hundreds of thousands of rockets and missiles, very well-trained forces who would have the capability to infiltrate Israel, which has always been the fear that there could be a repeat of a kind of Gaza-style October 7th infiltration like Hamas did. So, you know, Hezbollah has always been seen by Israel as a very real and viable threat against its safety. But in terms of what its endgame is, I mean, that is a matter of debate, because there are many analysts who think that this is leading nowhere. This is only leading to further escalation, and is prompting Hezbollah to respond. And then when Hezbollah responds, Israel responds, and this is exactly how this region can get dragged into a much wider regional and very, very, very dangerous conflict.
And as you say, perhaps the difference is, because we've heard from the UN who's warned that this could turn into another Gaza, but I guess the important difference is Hezbollah is so much more powerful than Hamas because it is a regional power with a far greater arsenal and weaponry. So the retaliatory attacks could be and will be significant for Israel. We've heard from the leader of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, who said that they will only back down if there is a ceasefire in Gaza. That seems very unlikely, doesn't it? Even with the latest offerings from the US peace negotiators.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, hopes for a ceasefire in Gaza are diminishing by the day. And Hassan Nasrallah, the reason why he entered this conflict was in solidarity with Hamas in what has been happening in Gaza. I think it's important to note, though, you know, though Hassan Nasrallah might be wishing to keep fighting until there is a ceasefire in Gaza, the majority of the population here does not want a war. Hezbollah is not the government. And I think it's really important to remember that there is a lot of pressure coming from domestically here, different political groups, different sects and religious groups as well, who are dead set against what is happening and are horrified to see what is happening to their country. Equally, you know, Hezbollah's supporters would say that this is an important thing for the group to do in solidarity with the Palestinian cause. They see themselves as the only viable option to defend the border from Israel from infiltration, like what happened in 2006. But certainly, as it stands, you know, both sides are very, very entrenched in their positions. Both are heavily armed, and this is incredibly dangerous. But I think it's important to note Iran, which backs Hezbollah, has been, you know, speaking tonight. There's been some messaging from them, you know, again, reiterating that point. They do not want to see this descend into a regional war. There has been, through back channels, a lot of talks via proxies, obviously, between Iran and the US, again, trying to work for some kind of agreement to take place between either Israel and Hezbollah directly, or, as you were mentioning there, a broader ceasefire in Gaza.
Mm. Okay, Olivia, thanks for your time. We're going to let you go. Stay safe and look after yourself.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. That's Olivia Lipodavan, their journalist and news editor at L'Orient Today. That was live from Beirut on the programme there on BBC Radio 5 Live. 12 minutes past 10 now. And Rachel Reeves made her first Labour conference speech as the Chancellor of the Exchequer this morning in Liverpool, promising no return to austerity. She said she would make hard but fair choices to sort out the economy. But after weeks of arguments over winter fuel payments and controversies about donations, the Chancellor did attempt to strike a more positive tone. That was until she was interrupted by a heckler protesting about arms sales to Israel. Rachel Reeves ended her speech with an upbeat message for the country's future.
We changed our party. Now let us change our country. This is our moment. Our chance to show that politics can make a difference, that Britain's best days lie ahead, that our families, our communities, our country need not look on while the future is built somewhere else, that we can and we will make our own future here. A Britain trading, competing and leading in a changed world. A Britain founded on the talent and the effort of working people. That is the Britain we're building. That is the Britain I believe in. Together, let's go and build it.
But even as the Chancellor was speaking, the result of a poll of nurses in England was released. Two-thirds of a record 145,000 turnout voted to reject the government's pay offer of 5.5% for this financial year. I asked Professor Nicola Ranger, the General Secretary of the RCN, if the release during the Chancellor's speech was a deliberate move.
No, it wasn't a deliberate move. We knew that our ballot for our members closed on Friday, and we informed both the government and the Treasury that those results would be coming out on Monday. So we did warn them in in advance, and it wasn't a deliberate attempt to sabotage the speech.
I can't imagine it went down too well with the party leaders, though. Are you worried about the impact of this in terms of your relations?
We've been very, very clear as a college that we absolutely support the government's diagnosis of what the challenges are in the National Health Service at this moment in time. Our nursing staff report many of the same challenges that are in the report. And we've made it quite clear to this government and in a letter to Wes Streeting that we very much intend to be part of the solution. But we do recognise, and our nurses have said loud and clear, that there is a very big recruitment and retention challenge here in the UK. And actually, we need some structural reform that is absolutely puts nursing at the centre of that. And we fully support the government's ambition to sort the NHS out. But it's going to be very difficult to sort out the NHS if you don't sort out nursing.
Mm. Nevertheless, though, some will say this is quite a provocative move, although it won't necessarily lead to strike action, will it? Because this isn't a ballot on strike action. This is what more of a kind of barometer of where your members are at right now. Is that a fairer way to describe it?
It is a barometer of where they're at, and what they really want is something. This decline in nursing has happened over several years, many years. And actually, they are a bit tired of rhetoric. They do need something that really puts their profession front and centre. And what this is a very clear indication of how nurses in this country feel when 145,000 of them have given their feedback. That is something that I think needs to be listened to. And we very much hope that the government sees that as it should be, in the fact that we need a solution. We're not looking for strike action. We're not looking for it to be more difficult for patients. But in the long term, if the NHS is going to be here for future generations, nursing has to be at the centre of that. And we've still got nearly 40,000 vacancies in nursing, 27% reduction in students coming into nursing. And we've got very experienced nurses leaving the profession in every sector. So we do need some solutions.
What is the matter with 5.5%? It is above inflation. It's more generous than what you've been offered in the past. Why is it not enough?
We recognise that and many of our some of our members have said they recognise that as a start. But what we're looking for is a real shift in how nursing is both valued and with recruitment and retention. And our members and our nursing staff have been loud and clear, this is not enough to really get things back on track with where nursing needs to be.
Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, has said that this is a good deal considering the state of public finances at the moment. We've been told time and time again about this £22 billion black hole from the government. We've heard these bleak warnings from the Chancellor, and we have a budget on the way. It doesn't sound like the government would be willing, certainly in the short term, to increase that offer. So what does that mean?
We recognise how difficult this is for both the government and the Chancellor. But if the diagnosis of the NHS, which we believe is accurate, then we can't afford not to sort out nursing, because at this moment in time, patients are coming to harm with both waiting times, waiting lists, and the general state of corridor care or the lack of care in this country. So actually, we can't afford not to start sorting out nursing, because they're key to the NHS. So we understand all the challenges, but actually, I think we feel that putting reform for nursing at the centre will in the long run be beneficial. I mean, we spent £3.2 billion on agency staff over the past few years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of this that focuses on valuing nursing would be at the core of getting the NHS better.
How much have you and your members been emboldened by the fact that the government has awarded or is going to award junior doctors a 22% pay increase after this long-running campaign of strikes?
We fully acknowledge that the junior doctors, or resident doctors as they are rightly now called, have got a pay award that should have been given to them. And it was hard fought. They went on strike 11 times to achieve that. And
do you do you and your members deserve 22%?
We deserve something that is going to make a seismic difference to the recruitment and retention in this country. And what we're keen to do is not talk about figures or try and start putting things in a difficult place.
But figures are at the crux of this, aren't they, Professor Range? With respect, I mean, it comes down to figures, doesn't it? You will have a figure in your mind of what that is. I appreciate that may weaken your negotiations and your stance if you tell me exactly what it is, but can you give me a rough idea of how far north of 5.5% it must be?
No, what we want to do at this moment is start having a constructive dialogue with West Streeting and the government, because we recognise this is about pay, this is about safe staffing, and this is about conditions that the health service is currently in. And we just want to be part of that solution and start the dialogue.
Final question to you, Nicola. What does this mean for industrial action? You're not going to agree to this 5.5%, so will there be more strikes in the near future?
We don't want to strike at this moment in time. We recognise that it's very tough for the patients we serve, and we recognise that for nursing staff, they want to be part of the solution. What we want as a Royal College of Nursing is to start having that constructive conversation around how we get things better for patients, the nursing profession, and ultimately the NHS. That is our primary motive, is to start getting things better. We do not, at this moment, plan to ballot our members for strike action.
That was Professor Nicola Ranger, the General Secretary of the RCN. If you want to get in touch regarding that, there's always a lot that people have to say when it comes to our public services, particularly the NHS. 85058 is the number to text if you'd like to text us, or 08085 909 693. We're going to talk about that takeover, our expected takeover of Everton in a moment's time. But first, let's turn our attention to the weather, because a lot of you listening right now will have been impacted by the shocking weather over the past 48 hours. The Environment Agency has warned that has issued 26 flood warnings, meaning flooding is expected. 89 alerts warning that flooding is possible in operation across central, western and southern England. The Met Office say that some areas may have seen as much as a month's worth of rain today. More than a dozen schools stayed closed across Bedfordshire, Northamptonshire and Cambridgeshire, and one junction of the M1 motorway was flooded, but in the Bedfordshire village of Clophill, some homes have been left without electricity, and residents have faced water coming up through their toilets and showers, while back gardens have turned into lakes.
When I got up this morning, the back garden was partially flooded. Now it's completely flooded, and it must be under about 8 or 9 inches of water. It's never been this bad since we've lived here in 2013.
Well, this is Nikki. She lives in Wetherill in Oxfordshire. Her home was flooded 12 years ago, and now it's happening again.
The whole of the high street has been like a huge river with a massive current, which you can't even walk safely across. So the neighbours have all been helping each other walk across the road so that they don't get swept away. Other neighbours have been bringing us thermos flasks of tea and coffee and offers of dinner and the like throughout the day, and even popping to the loo and a bit of warm space because we've got obviously no heating.
Well, let's speak to Kirsty McCabe, weather presenter and editor of Met Matters at the Royal Meteorological Society. Hi, Kirsty.
Hello there. Good evening.
I mean, a month's worth of rain in a day is absolutely devastating, isn't it? Just how unusual is that volume of rainfall?
Well, to put it into context, Woburn in Bedfordshire has had its wettest day on record. So it is unusual. It's never had that much rain in a day before. More than twice the monthly rainfall for September fell in a day. And that's more rainfall than they've had over the whole of summer, which hasn't been a great summer either.
No.
So they've had a phenomenal amount of rain, and they're not the only place. And the whole weekend's been very unsettled as well. So for much of England and Wales, it's not been ideal conditions. It's been very different though further north. Scotland and Northern Ireland, my family further north have been telling me it's great, lovely weather. But further south, it has been pretty horrendous. And it's just been this really slow moving area of low pressure that's just gone nowhere. And the same areas have had the rain again and again and again. So it's been really unusual, and it's timed very unfortunately with the autumn equinox. So it kind of feels like autumn has arrived with
just immediately.
Straight into autumn.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's caused it then? Is it just that sticky bit of low pressure?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's just the low pressure is kind of was just to the south of the UK, and all the bands of cloud and rain were swirling around it, and it was just moving very, very slowly, bringing the rain to the same places. And it's all tied in with the position of the jet stream, which we talk about quite a lot. And the jet stream is this ribbon of fast moving air high up in the atmosphere that tends to steer the areas of low pressure around on further down on the surface. And when that's to the south of us, then we end up with the low pressures affecting us more directly, because obviously in summer we tend to see the jet stream goes further north off to Iceland and we can get some nice weather. In the winter it tends to come further south to us and brings us the horrible wet weather. And at the moment it's just in the wrong place. So it's in the wrong place, and the low pressure was just really quite static.
And of course we've seen awful scenes coming out of Europe recently, in the likes of Hungary and Central and Eastern Europe, absolutely devastating floods happening there. And we can't place one weather event directly connecting it to climate change. But of course we are seeing more frequent and heavier rainfalls because of the climate change.
That's right. For a warmer world, for every sort of degree of warming, it can hold 7% more water vapour. And if there's more water in our atmosphere, when it does rain, it will pour. So if there's more, you know, more water around, it's going to be heavier, more intense downpours. And so the extreme weather is very much likely linked to climate change. There will be some climate attribution studies being done on the rainfall today, and certainly being done on the rainfall across Central Europe, which was the worst storm, Storm Boris, that affected central parts of Europe. That was the worst storm they've had in decades, if not longer. And so these attribution studies look at whether or not such an event could have happened without the impact of rising temperatures, without, you know, without climate change, without global warming, and how likely it would have happened. And I'm sure we'll find out in the coming days just, you know, was it linked to climate change? Quite possibly the fingerprint of climate change is on these events, because, you know, we've not seen rainfall like that at this time of year.
Yeah, it's very much a sad reality of what is happening in the world, isn't it? Kirsty, thank you very much. Good to talk to you. Kirsty McCabe there, weather presenter and editor of Met Matters at the Royal Meteorological Society. Don't forget the BBC weather app and the website, and of course your local BBC services as well provide some fantastic weather forecasts and weather services, so always keep with those if you possibly can. Right, you're listening to Johnny in for Gordon, very nearly 27 minutes past 10. It's been a tough start to the season for Everton, but could there be some good news finally on the way for the blue side of Liverpool? The Friedkin Group has agreed to buy the club from current owner Farhad Moshiri. The Texas-based firm had agreed a deal in principle to purchase the 94% stake in June. Talks were called off a month later after the two parties failed to finalise an agreement. That followed Miami-based 777 Partners being unable to complete a deal further this year. There's a lot going on. Let's speak to lifelong Everton fan Kathy Kegg, who joins us. Hi, Kathy, how are you?
Hi. Really excited at the thought we may be finally coming to a conclusion in the sale of the club.
Yeah, is it happening then in the drama that's unfolding? Is it something that you believe will actually be finalised this time around?
Cautious optimism, I think, amongst most fans. We are Evertonians, and it's taken us 3 years, and we've had so many hopeful signs, and it's not happened. And for a long time now, we've had an absent owner, no chairman, and an interim board. So we've been a bit rudderless at the top. And, you know, if the sale goes through, everybody knows we're struggling financially, we're struggling on the field. It's the first sign of real optimism in a long time.
Yeah, well, and then add to that, obviously, the points deductions as well over the past season or so. It's been a rough few months for you.
Horrible.
What do we know then? So Dan Friedkin, who is potentially buying the club, owns Serie A Roma as well. £5.7 billion net worth, apparently. Oh. So he's minted, Cathy. So presumably you want to see him get his hands in his pockets pretty soon.
Well, we need... I'm hoping it goes through because they've already apparently done the due diligence in the last time of exclusivity. Then we've got the agreement, haven't we? The due diligence has been done. So all it would seem we're waiting on is the Premier League, the FA and the FCA agreement. And I know in the Man United sale that didn't take longer than a few weeks. And if we could get this done before the January transfer window kicks in, then I think fans will just believe. For ages we thought, can we get through with the money we have? We didn't believe we were going to get any players in January. In fact, we felt we may have to sell the two players that are worth most to keep the club going. So if this goes through before January, we do have a very small squad. We do need to increase it. And if we could keep hold of our star player, if we can keep hold of Branthwaite, who everybody believes we were going to lose in January, that would be, you know, a real plus.
And it's being a fan of a club, Cathy, myself, that's gone through a few owners and particularly some owners that the fans didn't get on well with. It's hard to underestimate the difference it makes in the stands, isn't it? Just to your ability to enjoy watching the club and to actually have a relationship with the club if you don't feel that connection to the chairperson and actually when the relationship isn't going well, it does have a real impact on how you feel about the club.
We just haven't had a chairperson for a long time. Our owner's not been there. And Everton was very much a family club. Mm. And actually, this will be a huge change for us because a sort of a multi-club model is a million miles away from where we've always been seen as a club before. But, you know, we're getting somebody who has some football finance background, and you know, let's be honest, we've got a new ground round the corner, and it is an investment vehicle, isn't it? And they're interested in the entertainment value. I think it's an everything coming together at the right time if this goes through now.
Yeah, new owners, new chairman, and definitely a new stadium as well. Sad to say goodbye to Goodison, though, I imagine. Some great memories there.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it will be. It's tugging at the heartstrings already, you know, when you think, is this our last cup game? Is this the last thing? You know, you do feel that, but we need to move on. We do need a future, and we weren't getting anywhere with where we were.
Well, good luck with it, Cathy. We'll keep our eyes on this, no doubt, and I'm sure we'll catch up again.
Okay.
All right, take care. See you later. Lifelong Toffee there, Cathy Kegg on the programme. Right, 28 minutes to 11. Let's get your update now. That comes from Shabnam Yunusjewel.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Thank you, Johnny. Health officials in Lebanon say almost 500 people have been killed by Israeli airstrikes and more than 1,600 injured. Thousands of civilians in southern Lebanon have been fleeing the bombardment. Rachel Reeves says there'll be no return to austerity. In her first speech to a Labour Party conference as Chancellor, she said tough decisions were needed to deal with the economic legacy left by the Conservative government. Nurses in England have rejected the government's offer of a 5.5% pay rise. The Royal College of Nursing said a record number of its members voted on the deal and two-thirds were against it. And from tomorrow, the UK's biggest building society says new borrowers can request a mortgage up to six times their income with a 5% deposit. The Nationwide is trying to lure in first-time buyers. In sport, Everton could soon become the 10th club in the Premier League under majority American ownership. The Friedkin Group have reached an agreement to buy Farhad Moshiri's majority stake in the club, subject to approval from the Premier League, the Football Association and the Financial Conduct Authority. Manchester City fans are anxiously waiting on news of midfielder Rodri, who was substituted during the first half of Sunday's 2-2 draw against Arsenal. It's feared he could miss the rest of the season after initial tests showed damage to his ACL. City's three defeats last season came without the Spain international in the team.
The League Cup tie between AFC Wimbledon and Newcastle has been switched to St James's Park next Tuesday after the London club's stadium was affected by flooding. The third round match was due to be played at the Cherry Red Records Stadium on Tuesday night. Four games are still on tomorrow. Five Live will have commentary of Wycombe Wanderers against Aston Villa. Tonight, the League Two Lancashire derby between Fleetwood and Morecambe ended in a 2-2 draw. And in cricket, Glamorgan won the One Day Cup for the second time in 4 years as they held on to beat Somerset by 15 runs.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live, the voice of the UK.
On digital radio,
on BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live. Johnny Iamson.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Good evening, it's Johnny in for Gordon, 25 to 11. We're going to mark 50 years of CFAX in the next 5 or 10 minutes' time. I mean, it's not around anymore, sadly. Rest in peace. But ask your parents, kids. That's what I'll say. Very, very different times. First, though, let's return to the events at the Labour Party conference in Liverpool. Because we're just starting to get an idea now, aren't we, of what the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, is likely to say in his headline speech tomorrow as leader. And the message continues that tough decisions in the short term will open the door to national renewal. Let's get the latest from our political correspondent, who is in Liverpool, Ian Watson. Evening, Ian.
Good evening, Johnny.
It feels like there's been a bit of a pivot over the past couple of days, definitely trying to strike a much more positive message because it all felt quite doom and gloom, didn't it, for a while there?
It did. I just wonder how much is tone, though, and how much is actually substance, because effectively, there's, I suppose, a greater explanation of these so-called difficult decisions that the government is imposing on us, the cuts in the winter fuel payments, for example. We know there's going to be a tough budget ahead in the next month. But certainly in terms of the language, probably Rachel Reeves' speech today, the Chancellor's speech, and Keir Starmer's speech tomorrow are kind of companion pieces. She talked about optimism and the prize you could get at the end of this process if you make the right decisions now. What he's going to say is that, in effect, short-term pain is worth it for long-term gain. And to use his phrase, although it's a phrase that I guess lots of people use, I try to avoid using the word cliche, but I've just tumbled into it, is that there's light at the end of the tunnel. I think the worry that some delegates have, and certainly some of the trade unions, is just how long is that tunnel going to be? Is it a suburban railway tunnel or is it the Channel tunnel? How long is it going to be before they reach the promised land? So I think what he's going to try and do tomorrow is give a glimpse of where he wants to get to, a country with greater economic growth, greater investment, for example. There'll be a smattering of specific policies, I think, around skills, for example, and more he'll be saying on welfare reform, because he has to obviously identify savings in the budget in order to put investment elsewhere. But we'll get a little bit more of that detail. And I think there was a worry that here's a party with a big majority, and yet there's a bit of a cloud hanging over the conference, people feeling a little bit gloomy and worried indeed that businesses and others might feel gloomy and not give the country the investment and growth that it needs.
Well, that cloud as well, perhaps a little bit heavier and darker because of other headlines, the row about gifts and freebies, and as well the issues with the unions. The Royal College of Nursing's vote to reject pay increase, which perhaps stole a bit of oxygen from Rachel Reeves, although we spoke to them today and they said no, that definitely wasn't the intention. And then the group of unions who are voting just symbolically to overturn the decision on winter fuel allowance. Is there a feeling that the relationships are breaking down slightly already?
There certainly is a feeling that they're under strain. One union in particular, although others would have supported it, but one union in particular, the Unite Union, has denounced this whole vote on winter fuel payments as an outrage, as a disgrace, because what had happened is they expected to have that vote today, on the same day as Rachel Reeves' speech. It'd be high profile, it would be during the economy debate. And then they were told, nope, you can't have that vote. until later in the week, until Wednesday. And guess what? Probably Keir Starmer's disappeared by then. It's certainly not the same day as the Chancellor's speech. Everyone's getting their luggage packed up and ready to leave Liverpool. And I think one cabinet minister joked, actually, that the leader of that Unite Union has been pushing to get the winter fuel payments reversed. He said, yeah, this is a slot you're going to get. We're all going to be singing a rousing rendition of the red flag. We're then going to turn the conference lights off, and then you can take to the stage. So I think there is, as you can see, a little bit of tetchiness and cattiness going on here at the very least, but certainly I think a bit of a strain in those relations. You mentioned obviously the RCN, the nurses as well. That would be unwelcome for Rachel Reeves, because she was having to defend in her speech the public sector pay increases that she's already delivered, ones which the Conservatives say were a bad choice. And now, you know, here's an above inflation increase, and a union said, nope, sorry, that's not enough. And when public finances are under strain, she might feel she doesn't have enough leeway to try to meet that union halfway. That said, I think from her point of view, she'll be relieved to know that, indeed so will Keir Starmer, that the nurses don't seem to be appearing to want a big fight and to take industrial action just yet.
All right, Ian, we'll let you go because I know it's a long few days for you. Appreciate you staying up for us. Take care.
No problem. Thanks.
That's our political correspondent, Ian Watson, there in Liverpool. You're listening to Johnny Iannson in for Gordon tonight on BBC Radio 5 Live, 20 to 11 now.
I think we know who it is.
Love thy neighbour, and I tried, but
I didn't do it.
I believe we may be charging an innocent.
A woman police officer. Oh, look, flying pig.
I've got a daughter at home. Why would I risk it all?
In the spring of 1920 in the West Sussex village of Littlehampton, there was an interesting happening going on, a spate of poison pen letters, a story which was memorably brought to the big screen in the film Wicked Little Letters, starring Olivia Colman, among others. Now, it appears there's a modern-day equivalent, this time blighting a village in a different part of the UK. Residents of Shiptonthorpe in East Yorkshire say that anonymous letters they've received have created a village of poison after malicious mail began appearing through their letterboxes a couple of years ago. Humberside Police have been looking at some of the incidents, which involve letters described as personal, obscene and targeted. I've been speaking to Sarah May Buccieri, BBC journalist who's been investigating the story. And first up, I asked exactly where is Shiptonthorpe and what kind of community is it?
So Shiptonthorpe is a very small village. It's in East Yorkshire, sort of near York, a place where if you were living in East Yorkshire, you'd pass it on the way to York. It's one of those villages that's quite idyllic, picturesque, only home to around 500 people. And maybe the most important thing is everyone knows everyone in Shiptonthorpe.
Now, this is something which has been going on for some time. Just take us back to the beginning. What started happening and when did it all start?
So from my understanding, from the people I've spoken to within my investigation, this has been going on for around 2 years. And one of the ladies that I feature in the piece, she started getting letters 2 years ago, December 2022, when she went to her house, looked near her mailbox, and there was a letter. It was handwritten and it was addressed just to her. And she opened it. And in this letter, she said it was quite vile. It was very obscene. And at this time, what's quite important to remember is quite a lot of these people have connections to the parish council. And this woman was trying to run to be a councillor. And she opened this letter and it basically accused her of, in her words, being a loose woman. And it said things like the only way that she'd get into politics would be if she was to perform unspeakable things to men. And the letter ended by saying that she should be turned out on Beverly Westwood pastures with the rest of the cows. Now, she was terrified by this. And there's a lot of things in the letter that she couldn't tell me in the interview. She couldn't bring herself to say it. Clearly, being even 2 years on, still so struck by it all. Mm. She reported this to the police. She ripped up the letter. Which the police said she shouldn't have done, ripped up the letter, and the police said that they couldn't really investigate it, but to let them know if it happened again. And she's had three more letters since then, including letters to her husband as well. So it's been ongoing for 2 years. Wow. And it's been quite targeted.
But it isn't just targeting one person or one family, is it?
No.
I think this has become quite insidious within the community.
Yes, so it has featured other people. Another person that's within my reports basically received this letter. I've seen it myself and it's really eerie to read because in this letter, it's phrased as if the writer is this person's friend, and it urges its reader to be honest with themselves. It basically criticises this reader, and it criticises their wife, saying that he should get control over her to sort her out. And in this letter, which is supposed to be from a caring friend, which is not anything that your caring friend would say to you, it's signed from a caring, dear friend. So that's quite an eerie one. That's one of them. There's another one that says things like, you must enjoy humiliation. There's one that says, you attack good, honest people. Look in the mirror. You will see who is to blame. And one, which is perhaps one of the nastier ones, says, I hope cancer finds you.
Wow. I mean, it sounds awful for people living there. You've been, as you say, investigating this and speaking to the community. Let's have a listen to actually how some of the residents have been left feeling. These are their words, which have been voiced by actors.
It was basically accusing me of being, I suppose, what you could call a loose woman. It was having a go at me because at that time I'd made a decision to run as a ward councillor. And it was basically saying that the only way I would ever get anywhere within politics would be if I was to perform unspeakable things to men. And it was just vile. I think it ended by saying that I should be turned out on Beverly Westwood pastures with the rest of the cows.
I was frightened for my partner and I was worried that anybody would approach her because I didn't know who else had knowledge of this letter.
Even people who haven't received a letter say the main weapon here is the writer's words.
A cloud of vitriol has fallen over Shipton Thorpe. I know for a fact that some people have decided to leave the village. People come to a village like Shipton Thorpe for a quiet, tranquil, community-spirited life. And that's being damaged badly by one or two devilish people. In my opinion, I believe this constitutes a hate crime.
It's a really stark illustration, Sarah May, of the impact it's having on people. You know, we mentioned in our introduction the film Wicked Little Letters, starring Olivia Colman, and which is quite a, you know, fun, playful film. But this is anything but that for people, and it's really affecting their lives.
Absolutely. I think it's so easy for us all to listen to a story like this and think that sounds like a Netflix drama. That sounds like this drama. When, as you say, this is people's reality. When I first heard of this, I thought it was quite insane, really. I thought, what a wild story. And then digging more into it, the more I uncovered, the worse it got, really. But what is important to remember, this is people's real lives. These people are so terrified of this writer, they couldn't show their face in my reports. I've had to revoice them.
Really?
Yeah, they were so scared, even speaking to me. And it's one of those interviews, perhaps with a woman, that's going to probably stick with me forever. When I asked her what was in these letters, and she just broke down. It's like a floodgate opened and she was remembering it all. I could see her eyes just glazed over as she took herself back in time, thinking about these letters, which that first letter was 2 years ago now. And it's still stuck with her. That gives you the idea of just how nasty all this is.
And nobody has any ideas over who's responsible for this or the motive behind this, why they would be doing it.
No, I think it's the type of place where if you went to Shipton Thorpe and you spoke to people, I think everyone, like in life, theorises, don't they? I think everyone would have maybe ideas, but no solid idea of who it definitely is. So people aren't 100% on that, but what they are 100% is it is ruining a lot of people's lives in the community. You heard in the clip there, that man says that people have sold their homes. He calls it a village of poison, a cloud of vitriol. So it is something that's really shaping some people's lives in that tiny little village.
And I mean, a lot of people have camera doorbells now, and I think you said the first letters anywhere at least were handwritten. So has the police been able to get any information? Because also presumably this falls under the Malicious Communications Act. This would be illegal by the sounds of it.
That's a tricky one. That's something that I've definitely put to the police. And basically what they say a few things. So Humberside Police say they spoke to the woman that's featured in our report, the lady you heard in the clip that's been revoiced. They say that they checked her CCTV, but the content of the letter was unavailable. And that's because she ripped it up because she was so scared. So no further investigative opportunities were able to be obtained. They do say they gave her safety advice, But she said that she's had three more letters since, and she's reported all of them to the police and nothing's been done. They also have looked into that letter from a dear friend, the one that I said was quite eerie. And they say that this didn't contain any aggressive language, so no criminal offences had been committed. It almost falls in a sort of loophole that somehow someone is getting away with this. But what is 100%, what is definite, is it's definitely rocking this little community.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what a fascinating but awful story for that local community. Where can people find a bit more about this, Sarah May? As you say, you've been reporting on this for some time now, so I'm sure that people want to go out and dig a bit more information on this.
Yeah, so if people would like some more information, it's kind of the first thing if you Google Shiptonthorpe, you'll find the BBC article, which kind of lays out our whole report. There'll also be the TV report in BBC Breakfast tomorrow morning.
Okay, lovely to talk to you, and fingers crossed that community can get some sort of resolution to this. And really appreciate your time reporting on this, Sarah May. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sarah May Buccieri there reporting on that story in Shiptonthorpe. 11 minutes to 11. Oh, this is wonderfully retro, and I love this. Imagine a world where you can't call up the football results at the touch of a button, read the latest news headlines, find an up-to-date or up-to-minute weather forecast, or just, I don't know, watch endless videos of cats. Sounds miserable, doesn't it? But that's what life was like in the mid-70s. Well, not just the mid-70s. I mean, that was way up until the late 90s, really. Until, that is, CFAX came along. CFAX was, in many ways, the internet of its time, before the actual internet was a thing. It was powered down in 2012, but this month marks a significant anniversary. It's 50 years since the launch of the first 24/7 news service. Let's speak to author of the book Exposure, Felicity Cowie, joins us, who worked on CFAX between 1997 and 1999. Felicity, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for inviting me onto your show.
Oh, listen, take me back to the mid late 90s. I mean, for kids listening, for Gen Zers, just explain a little bit about CFAX and what the world was like back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredibly different, I guess, from now. It's quite amazing. It's all happened within my own lifetime. I mean, I am only 50 myself, the same age as CFAX. In fact, it started in 1974. yeah. But by the time I worked on it, it was when it had started to roll out to the BBC regions. And yeah, it was, I mean, you could get the football results at the touch of, not one button, but three. you had to sort of type in, three numbers, and then the football results would pop up on your television screen. You would use your TV remote to get this up. But it was a huge thing. I mean, my dad would sort of tune in on Saturday, be sort of watching the football scores coming in live, really, yeah, on CFAX. And there's all kinds of stories on the internet of people, you know, finding out results they didn't want to see, and then, you know, sort of going back a few minutes later hoping the BBC had got it wrong, but no, they hadn't. It wasn't the result they wanted.
I think it was in the, was it the 300s? 300 and odd, the football results?
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah. I think it was like 306 or something. Yeah, I've got that wrong, I'm sure. I mean, but yeah, it's 300, yeah.
It's such a different world, you know, when you talk about the analogue world, that was kind of us crossing over into the digital world, wasn't it? I mean, it really was exciting at the time, this idea that you could get up to the minute news instead of having to wait every half an hour as you did, yeah, watching the telly. It was pretty groundbreaking.
Well, it was, but in some ways, but then in other ways it was hilarious, because really there was like the CFAX computer. there was like one computer in the newsroom that I sat at and I did the CFAX news on. And in fact, at the same time, the BBC online service was starting up as well. And there was, yeah, one computer again, and my memory of this, I think, is right. There was one computer in the newsroom, and that was that was the internet. so there wasn't lots of devices or anything. There was really just, you know, this one terminal. It was actually perched on the edge of the main desk that the television news for the south of England was kind of worked on. So I sort of had this seat on the television desk, but I was sort of plugging away, writing my CFAX headlines and stuff all day.
Could you choose the colours, or was that a set thing?
No, it was a set thing.
Was it?
Yeah. And actually, it was the sort of... It was almost like sort of predated Twitter and stuff like that, because it had a very strict character count and you had to write the headlines. I can't actually remember the number of characters now, but you had to write your headlines in a specific number of characters, and they all had to be uniform. So, I mean, it was a very good lesson in, you know, how to write headlines, which has sort of stood me in good stead for later in my career. But the colors were all preset.
Right.
But I would find after 10-hour shifts, I would kind of go home and I would, you know, do sort of late shifts and I'd go to sleep and I would sort of sleep in, I'd have dreams about all these colors.
Dreaming in CFAX.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, not to necessarily mention Arrival, but I'm going to anyway, but Teletext, mm-hmm. which was the ITV and Channel 4 equivalent as well. I vividly remember spending many an afternoon playing Bamboozle, which was the kids' quiz on Channel 4. And then the idea that my mum and dad would be sat there trying to book a holiday watching CFAX, and my dad would be, Patricia, Pat, we could go to Tenerife for 290, and then it would change screen and they'd have to wait 5 minutes for it to come back around again. Get a pen and paper and write a number down. We'll call the travel agent.
A different era. It was, and you had to kind of all sort of share out, like you're saying, really, like all your different, I mean, it, you know, it's a clever thing in that it had everybody's interests in one place, but it was all on one device, really, in your house. So
yeah.
You kind of all had to
It was
of
the posh telly in the front
turn.
Room. That I, oh, yeah, my TV in the bedroom when I eventually got one didn't have CFAX.
No. So, yeah, there would be a bit of a thing going on about. And I think when the lottery started as well, you know, the lottery numbers coming up, people. So there was sort of like, I suppose, events that people would in some ways come to CFAX for in the way that they do, you know, now sort of breaking news stories and things like that. That's where news got broken most of the time, I guess, because it wasn't stuck in a time slot. You know, you could run it the whole time.
It's brilliant to take a trip down memory lane, Felicity. It really is. I'm going to go home tonight and at 3 o'clock in the morning watch old videos of CFAX, a melting of technologies together. Lovely to talk to you. Thanks a lot, Felicity.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Take care. Felicity Cowie there, author of the book Exposure, who worked on CFAX. How about that? Memories of CFAX. Get in touch. 85058 is the number to text. Now, it may have finished goalless, but Saturday's draw at Selhurst Park between Crystal Palace and Manchester United marked a significant first. It saw the launch of a new piece of vision enhancement technology, which helps fans with sight loss to enjoy the game clearer than ever. Joanna Liddington is the head of operations at Give Vision. Last week told Gordon on this programme how the technology worked.
The headset connects in with the local TV cameras around the pitch, and this enables the person using the headset to either use the headset camera itself and focus on what they want to see, or they can connect in with those TV cameras and get the mixed feed sent directly to them in real time via a private 5G network and kind of watch everything alongside their friends and family. We spoke to a lot of Premier League teams and we found that they had about 5 to 7 people with low vision that they were aware of going to each match. As you have 1 in 30 people in the UK with some form of vision impairment, we should really be seeing numbers in the hundreds, if not thousands, attending football matches.
Well, one of those who got to experience the game and this new way of watching it is Stephen Anderson. And I'm pleased to say that Stephen's here. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Good evening. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, great. I mean, a 0-0 draw, not the best way to display the technology, but what was it like to see the game for the first time this way?
Well, I think that's the thing for me, that the fact it was 0-0 didn't really matter. Not least because where we were sitting, we were given the opportunity to predict the score, and I predicted it correctly. So I actually won a signed ball. So it worked out very well for
well
me.
Well done.
Yes, it was a wonderful experience, and being able to participate in the game and actually join in with everything rather than just rely on other people telling me what's going on and what their opinion is. Was quite something. I'll give a very direct example. During the game, there was a rather questionable tackle by Martinez on Kamada. And I called it. I said, that is a red card level offence because
really?
That is two-footed. I have never been able to call something right that the referee, with respect, got wrong. And I've never been able to adamantly and vehemently turn to the person next to me, ironically it was actually Joanna from Give Vision, and say, that was a two-footed tackle, that is a red card. And she wasn't sure because she did, ironically didn't see it.
Really?
So,
wow.
So that is a real, I cannot describe how much of a joy it is when those roles are reversed a little bit and I'm actually able to not just take in the atmosphere, but take in the game. And I think that's something that's really important.
Yeah, and I guess that means as well that you take part in this collective experience that you haven't been able to before. Yes, you're there, but actually being able to see it and engage with it with other fans completely changes the experience for you.
Yes, I think the big thing that I want non-visually impaired people to appreciate is if you can't see those key moments, the handballs, the fouls, the penalty shouts, the goals, and then suddenly you can, it's just, when I put it like that, I think it brings home how much of a priceless gem the Give Vision headsets are, and I really do want this to become much more widespread.
And your vision issues mean that you see things, if it's, say, 4 metres away, it seems about 60 metres away, I think you've said before. So
yes,
this is obviously something which opens up everything to you. What would happen before then? Would you have someone describing the events to you, or would you just not go and watch the games?
I've tried everything. I would either use the I would use the camera on my mobile phone, which would, one, give me a repetitive strain injury, and two, stewards didn't like it because they thought I was sending a copy to another country for $5.99. but it would cause all sorts of bother. I'd then try binoculars and would have a repetitive strain injury because I'd be holding the binoculars up for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
This immerses me in the game. And also, I have a problem with excess light. These headsets, they're very much like virtual reality headsets. They block out other light. I can see everything.
I'm so pleased for you, Stephen. It's just fantastic, and I hope this opens up the game to you and a lot of other people with visual impairments. Thank you so much for being with us, Stephen. That's Stephen Anderson there, who used these goggles for the first time.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. Lebanon says Israeli airstrikes have now killed almost 500 people, including 35 children. It's been the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border in nearly two decades. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, told Lebanese civilians to leave locations used by the armed group Hezbollah. But the Lebanese health minister, Firas Abeid, said for many, the warning came too late.
If you look at the areas that were targeted, the vast majority, if not all of them, were civilian areas. And even, you know, if you look at the time between those messages that were sent and the time the attack started, you could see that this was not serious at all. I mean, the aim was just, in my opinion, is a show.
Rachel Reeves has used her first Labour conference speech as Chancellor to rule out a return to austerity when she sets out her budget next month. She stood by her cuts to winter fuel payments for many pensioners, insisting tough decisions were needed. But she also said that Britain's best days lay ahead. As the Chancellor spoke to delegates in Liverpool, it was announced that nurses in England have rejected the government's award of a 5.5% pay rise for this financial year. The Royal College of Nursing said its members didn't feel valued, but the RCN's General Secretary, Nicola Ranger, insisted the timing of the announcement wasn't deliberate.
We knew that our ballot for our members closed on Friday, and we informed both the government and the Treasury that those results would be coming out on Monday. So we did warn them in advance, and it wasn't a deliberate attempt to sabotage the speech.
A United Nations report has found that Russians are now subject to systematic human rights violations, with all dissent brutally repressed. The investigation was carried out by the UN's special rapporteur on Russia, Mariana Katsarova, who interviewed activists and lawyers in the country. She said punitive sanctions were being imposed for the most minor activities.
7 years for reading an anti-war poem or producing a play perceived to be anti-war. Two women are still in prison for that. 7 years for posting on social media.